Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. 227 years ago today, on July 14th, 1789, French citizens and soldiers stormed the Bastille in Paris, which is generally accepted to be the beginning of the French Revolution and is France's Independence Day. The Bastille was attacked with an enthusiasm of heroism such as only the highest animation of liberty could inspire, Thomas Paine wrote in The Rights of Man. It is an age of revolutions in which everything may be looked for. Catherine Bridget Snow, who is a former program director for KMUN and afterward worked for many years at National Public Radio, lived in Paris for a time and wrote an article about the assault on the Bastille for the North Coast Times Eagle, which reprinted it a time or two and more, and I have read it on this program just as often. Liberty and the Bastille by Catherine Bridget Snow. And I apologize for any mispronunciations of French words. If you stand at night in the center of Paris's golden-lit bridge, La Pointe de la Concorde, and face roughly west, you will see to the right La Tour Eiffel, its graceful lines and small lights against a dark blue sky. To the left is the Cathedral de Notre Dame, sitting quietly at a bend in the slow river, looking small in the distance. It's not far from the cathedral to where you stand, perhaps a 30-minute walk past the Palace of Justice, past the Louvre Museum, where one king used to hunt on horseback down the long halls, through the Garden of the Tuileries to the Place de la Concorde. La Place de la Concorde is a whirlpool of cars, four deep, swirling around a tall monument at the center, then streaming down the Seine or up to the Champs-Élysées. The U.S. Embassy is just on the other side of the place, as are the fine leather glove and handbag shops. This is what you would see as an American visitor to the city. If, however, you were a Parisian factory worker in the summer of 1789, you might have tread those 30 minutes from the Hotel de Ville behind Notre Dame to Les Invalides, between the Pointe de la Corde, and taken one of the 32,000 muskets stored there to defend yourself against the king's troops rumored to be surrounding Paris. And if you were a woman a few years later, you might have sat with Dickens's Madame Defarge in the Place de la Concorde near the guillotine and knitted as tumbril after tumbril rolled past, carrying aristocracy to be beheaded. Tradition has it that the French Revolution began with the storming of the Bastille in a peasants' revolt against aristocratic power, the 14th of July, 1789. But the crowd's original intent was not to free prisoners. It was to demand ammunition to protect the people of Faubourg Saint-Antoine, towards whom the Bastille cannon was pointed. There had been minor riots for 3 days over the state of the Parliamentary Assembly at Versailles, and Parisians feared more violence from the aristocracy and military. The people at Faubourg Saint-Antoine feared cannon fire from the Bastille to the west, and an imminent attack from some 300,000 troops rumored to be coming from the east. There were only 7 prisoners in the Bastille on July 14, 1789. None political prisoners. The fortress had long been used only for discreet imprisonment of the wealthy or influential. While it still represented despotism for the workers, few, if any, of the thousands amassing outside it that day were in a position to know who might be inside the fortress. The government had been unsteady for some time, but the balance of power tipped discernibly towards the assembly in mid-June, when King Louis XVI ordered the Parliamentary Assembly, the Third Estate, to dissolve, and they refused. The king stopped just short of using military force. Instead, on July 11th, Louis sent the Director of Finances, Necker, into exile. Bankers and shopkeepers who had looked looked to Necker's fiscal policies to restore a sound economy, protested, and marched up the Champs-Élysées into skirmishes with the king's soldiers. Communications with the court at Versailles were cut off July 13th. Rumors flew that the king's troops were surrounding the city, strengthened with large groups of brigands, the outlaws who destroyed crops from village to town and survived through smuggling and violence. Parisians made the trek to the Bastille on the 14th for ammunition and self-defense. They did not know that the governor inside the fortress, Delaunay, had no provisions, no orders from Versailles, an ineffective cannon, and a garrison of mostly aged soldiers who did not want to open fire at the people. Negotiations between Delaunay and members of the bourgeoisie began amicably until each side, misinterpreting the other, thought it was under attack. Crowds pushed across the drawbridge. Most of the garrison escaped and the rest were killed. Delaunay made it as far as the Hotel de Ville before his head was speared to parade around the city. It was the beginning of a violence that would escalate in 3 years to the Reign of Terror, the bloody extermination of the aristocracy romanticized in A Tale of Two Cities and The Scarlet Pimpernel. It is controversial whether or not the economy played a large role in the Revolution of 1789. The price of grain had been the source of unrest and riots in the provinces since early that year. Relaxed export laws had pulled much of the grain from storage, and the harvest of 1788 was poor. Bread prices doubled in Paris and quadrupled in the provinces. Vintners were especially hard hit, since the grape harvest had been abnormally good, driving down the price of wine. The aristocracy was suspected of a conspiracy to hoard grain and keep the price up. The brigands terrorizing the countryside were suspected of being in the pay of the aristocracy. However, it was Necker's dismissal that provided the people of Paris with a concrete reason for massive protest. Necker had a name for reform and sound finance, and it had been disagreement over specific economic proposals which put the very existence of the assembly in question. Paris was on edge over the threats to the Third Estate and the rumored looming massacre by government troops and brigands. Necker's exile was the outrage that began the riots. In the provinces, word of the Paris riots spread, and peasants attacked the chateau, destroying records of credit and debt. Their own revolt was not a direct protest of events at Versailles. They had distrusted Necker for supposed deals with grain millers, which benefited landowners. The peasants were starving, they were penniless, and they were afraid of the traveling brigands. As the struggle continued between the king and the increasingly powerful National Assembly and the various interests of the bourgeoisie and the working class, the food shortage did not abate. By October, the aristocracy had all exited to Versailles, and the Parisians pushed for Louis's return to Paris as a solution to the unrest and economic crises. He returned in early October to the Louvre, and the assembly followed, installing itself at the Tuileries on November 9th. In the ensuing struggle for power between the king and the assembly, the king gradually lost his sovereign rule. Few people would have foreseen the coming terror when the guillotine would reign sovereign over the bloody Place de la Concorde. The Tuileries are just east of the Place de la Concorde, with well-groomed trees planted in even squares and long straight paths which stretch to the Louvre. Walking north across to Place de la Concorde, you can turn and walk through the long gardens toward the lights of the Louvre beyond, or you could meander up the Champs-Élysées, admiring the fur coats and the pet poodles which parade up and down the boulevard. Either way you turn, you will walk through the Place de la Concorde. History is alive in Paris. The passion is embedded in the streets. As you walk through the place, it takes only a little concentration to imagine the streets sticky with blood and yourself pressed into the crowd, standing before the guillotine. And that was Liberty and the Bastille by Catherine Bridget Snow. Some of you might be aware that Sunday, is the 80th anniversary of the Spanish Civil War, which is separated from the French Revolution by a century and a half, the Pyrenees Mountains, and conceptual context. The Spanish Civil War started on July 17, 1936, when the Spanish army under General Francisco Franco attacked to overthrow the elected Republican government. The following was written by Julian Coleman, who is a news editor at the British newspaper, The Guardian. I dedicate this portion of the program to the memory of Delmer Berg, the last known survivor of the famously infamous Abraham Lincoln Brigade of American volunteers who fought in Spain against Franco's fascists. He died at age 100 in February this year. And I'd like to read now, with apologies for my mispronunciation of Spanish, Ghosts of the Spanish Civil War by Julian Coleman. On a sunny morning in early May, a small group gathered at the entrance to Barcelona's Fossar de la Pedrera, or mass grave of the quarry. They were a mix of ages and types. An elderly woman, smartly dressed, clutched flowers as she stood next to her middle-aged son. A father and his young daughter waited patiently. The Fossar is relatively inaccessible from the city. Hidden by sheer walls of sandy rock, it rarely features in the tourist itineraries. Local people generally stay away, but once a month, small huddles can be seen making a dignified progress between the plaques and monuments, tactfully slowing down as members of the group linger over a particular name or a certain tribute. This is a place of mourning. Following the end of the Spanish Civil War in 1939, the bodies of 1,700 Republicans, soldiers, civilians, people caught in the wrong place at the wrong time, were carted through the center of Barcelona and dumped here without dignity or ceremony after summary execution by the fascist forces of General Francisco Franco. Their bullet-riddled corpses were covered in quicklime before being thrown into a pit, the better to ensure their rapid decomposition. In a grim example of fascist humor, the medical certificates of many of the dead reported the cause of death as internal hemorrhage. A memorial was finally built in 1985, and for the past few years, monthly tours have been conducted in Catalan by an Englishman, Nick Lloyd, who has lived in Barcelona for 28 years. More often than not, on days such as these, Lloyd ends up doing as much listening as talking. The Fossar de la Pedrera is full of untold stories. The woman with flowers turns out to be the granddaughter of Yuldald Coma Gironella, a Republican justice of the peace from the small town of Sant Vicenç de Torelló, an hour's drive from Barcelona. Until a few months ago, his family had no idea where his remains were. Then friends spotted his name on one of the tall columns listing the dead. So here they are. Rosa Volquea Coma tearfully says a prayer for the grandfather, shot 2 years before she was born, and worries aloud over whether he was allowed to receive last rites. A few yards away, Alphonse Vasquez Obiols is showing his 13-year-old daughter, Joanna, the name of Antonio Alcovero Alarien, a municipal policeman in Barcelona when the nationalist uprising took place. He was my grandmother's brother, says Vasquez. He testified against someone who took part in the uprising. He was forced to testify. It was his job. He wasn't politically involved. When Barcelona fell to the fascists in 39, Antonio was arrested. My aunt went every day to the jail to bring him breakfast. One day she was told he was killed. The family were never given the body. Against the will of his aunt, Vasquez has sought out the relevant files. My aunt said, "Don't do this, just forget. That generation is still a bit frightened. They said it happened a long time ago. We want to forget." When the subject of the Civil War is talked about, the two sides of Spain divide immediately. Another father in the Fossar group has reluctantly come alone. Sergio Lobo wanted to bring his 12-year-old daughter, Candela, but she backed out. She says they're not teaching her about this at school, he says. She doesn't feel like she understands enough. Candela is not alone. A major survey a few years ago found that 69% of 14 to 17-year-old respondents said they had received little or no information about the Civil War. The body of Lobo's grandfather has never been found, as remains the case with tens of thousands of other Republican casualties. I have no idea where my grandfather is buried, he says. Two things torment Lobo: the disappearance without trace of his grandfather, and the sense that his daughter's generation will grow up in ignorance of the bloody times that took his life. Why haven't we done what other countries have done, he asks. Why haven't we done what Germany did and performed the hard work of remembering and debating? Why don't schools do more? I fear that my daughter will not be able to tell her daughter about what the Civil War really was. 80 years after Franco's troops launched a military uprising against the elected Republican government of Santiago Cesares Quiroga on 17 July 1936, there is still no museum dedicated to telling the full story of the Civil War. Around the Aragon battle sites where George Orwell fought alongside the revolutionary Marxist militiamen of the PUM, small museums can be found chronicling the bitter fighting on that crucial front. In the southern port of Cartagena, the Republic's naval base, a former air raid shelter now houses a series of galleries portraying local experience of the conflict. In Guernica, the Basque town bombed by German and Italian planes in April 1937 and portrayed in its agony by Picasso, there's a permanent exhibition devoted to the theme of peace. But nowhere is there a museum that attempts to tell the unexpurgated tragic tale of Spain's suffering between the summer of 1936 and April 1939. It's pretty astonishing, says Paul Preston, the eminent British historian of 20th century Spain, that there isn't a museum that tries to give the whole picture and represent all the sides to the Civil War. Preston sits on the Association of the International Museum of the Civil War, which has formally asked Barcelona's mayor, Ada Colau, to provide a suitable building for such a museum. Abroad, the Spanish Republicans' doomed struggle against Franco and the fascist powers of Germany and Italy was commemorated in the work of writers such as Orwell, André Malraux, Ernest Hemingway, Alva Bessie, and Victor Serge. The world remembers a noble fight to safeguard a fledgling democracy from the fascist menace of Franco, backed by Adolf Hitler and Benito Mussolini. But during the decades of the Franco dictatorship, a counterversion of history was prosecuted with ferocious energy, one in which the nationalist soldiers stepped in to save old Catholic Spain from the alien, hostile forces of atheism and communism. Spain suffered 40 years of national brainwashing and terror, says Preston. The aim of that war had been to destroy as many Republicans as possible, and under the Franco regime, you saw the institutionalism of his victory. War memorials appeared across Spain, but only the nationalist dead were named and remembered. Survivors such as Sergio Lobo's widowed grandmother, who eventually found work as a cleaner in a Madrid barracks, were warned to knuckle down, say nothing, and forget. When she asked questions about her husband, they told her, "Listen, you have two children. Work and keep quiet," Lobo recalls. The savage repression of Republican Spain eventually ran out of steam. By the time of Franco's death in 1975, the mood had altered. But the new impulse was not to rehabilitate the losers of the conflict, but to consign the country's bloodiest episode to history. The notion that, to use the phrase coined by another historian, Paloma Aguilar, a collective insanity had gripped Spain, became the founding spirit of Spain's new democracy. A general amnesty was granted for crimes committed during the Civil War, and for 30 years or so, an unofficial Pacto de Olvido, a pact of forgetting, held. Not anymore. One book, a novel, sums up a generational shift that has now led Spaniards such as Alphonse Vasquez and Sergio Lobo to ignore the advice of aging relatives and seek to shine a light on the country's unhappiest secrets. The Soldiers of Salamis, published in 2001, follows a middle-aged journalist's attempt to unravel the truth of a famous incident toward the end of the Civil War when a prominent phalangist escapes a Republican firing squad. The recently bereaved narrator, a fictionalized version of the book's author, Javier Cercas, interviews a member of the battalion charged with performing the execution. The Civil War veteran is now in his 80s. Explaining the motives for stirring up old enmities, Cercas tells the old man, "I just want to talk to you for a while so I can tell what really happened, or your version of what happened. It's not a question of settling scores. It's about trying to understand." Cercas' meditation on memory struck an extraordinary chord with the Spanish public, shooting to the top of the bestseller list and staying there. A film of the book came out in 2003 to similar acclaim. The significance of Soldiers of Salamis was that it spoke to the notion of filial duty, says Sebastian Faber, a U.S.-based academic who is about to publish a book entitled The Memory Battles of the Spanish Civil War. It spoke to a middle-aged generation whose parents had died or would soon pass away, and who began to feel they owed it to their parents and grandparents to know fully what happened and to transmit it to the next generation. So you are seeing this generational shift in Spain, the feeling that past suffering creates a duty to tell. And that was Faber. Over the past decade or so, the new spirit of inquiry has generated an outpouring of books, films, and documentaries about the Civil War. In the former battlefields of Aragon, Catalonia, and Castile, searches conducted by Emilio Silva's Association for the Recovery of Historical Memory, founded in 2000, have led to the recovery of the remains of nearly 2,000 victims of the Francoist killings. Like the fictional narrator of Soldiers of Salamis, Silva went looking for the past, beginning with the location and exhumation of the remains of his own grandfather from a ditch in northwest Spain. His work helped to launch a memory movement focused on reclaiming the lives erased from the history books during the Franco era. Then in 2007, the socialist prime minister, José Luis Rodríguez Zapatero, went far beyond what his predecessors were willing to risk in the 1980s and 90s. Though opposed by the conservative Popular Party, Zapatero passed a law of historical memory, a kind of legislative riposte to the Pacto de Olvido. The new law formally condemned the Franco regime, gave recognition to victims on both sides, and offered support to their relatives. It also decreed that overtly Francoist symbols to be removed from public buildings and spaces. So has common sense shifted to the extent that the previously unthinkable was now possible, a comprehensive museum of the Spanish Civil War? Outside the Rose of Fire bookshop in Barcelona's University District, a faded banner proudly celebrates the spirit of the tumultuous summer of 1936. Neither wars nor frontiers. CNT, Catalunya. Once the Rose of Fire is run on a voluntary basis by the CNT, the National Federation of Labor, once the mightiest force in Republican Barcelona. During the first summer of the Civil War, its members defeated the nationalist insurgency, took over the city's factories, and turned the Ritz Hotel into a workers' canteen. For a short-lived period, they ran the entire city. Now, there is just a bookshop, albeit one with treasures, such as the Golden Book of the Spanish Revolution, produced by anarchist exiles in 1946 to mark the 10th anniversary of the Civil War. The introduction still packs an emotional punch as it declaims, those of us who lived those unique and unforgettable days, days destined to light up the history of the world, will never lose the memory of them. Behind the counter of the Rose of Fire, Carmen is the current custodian of those memories. This is a unique place, she says. We are keeping the story alive. And if the story is not kept alive in Barcelona, where will it be kept alive? This is the place where the anarchist revolution really happened. It is a unique place in the world. In 2016, the politics of Barcelona and Catalonia are dominated by the dream of independence from Spain. But along with the Fossar de la Pedrera, throughout the city there are plentiful reminders of the traumatic history it shared with Madrid, Seville, Valladolid, and Burgos. Dr. Pelai Pages, professor of contemporary history at the University of Barcelona, is one of Spain's foremost historians of the Civil War and a prime backer of a museum as a central place to tell the story of 1936 to 1939. There will never be a consensus on what happened between 1936 and 1939, says Sebastian Faber. And even if that were possible, there will never be a consensus about how to narrate what happened. But in a democracy, there should be a higher kind of agreement that it is good to collectively discuss the past as a society. Or, as Pelai Pages puts it, a museum dedicated to the country's darkest hours can help to safeguard its future. The Civil War was the most important event in the history of 20th century Spain. It was the prologue of the Second World War. It generated a dictatorship that lasted almost 40 years, and its effects continue into our times, Pages says. Creating a museum is a means to preserve the historical memory of an event that should never be repeated. And that was Ghosts of the Spanish War by Julian Comar. The general distinction between a revolution and a civil war is that civilians directly revolt to overthrow a government in a revolution, and a civil war is essentially when factions within a government wage war against each other. But these terms often overlap, such as the American Revolution was a revolt against England with the aim of separation rather than overthrow, unlike the French Revolution, which dethroned a monarchy and guillotined an aristocracy. And the Spanish Civil War was a military counter-revolution to overthrow a popularly elected government. Famous symbols of liberty emerged from both the French Revolution and the Spanish Civil War. The former was iconic, the result of a painting by Eugène Delacroix of Lady Liberty Leading the Charge, which commemorated the Second French Revolution in 1830 against the reinstalled monarchy of Louis X following the Napoleonic Wars, and which became, in ex post facto simultaneity, symbolic with the Revolution of 1789. Lady Liberty's counterpart in the Spanish Civil War was La Passionaria, a real woman named Dolores Ibárruri, who was hailed worldwide as the heroic symbol of liberty against tyranny. She died at age 93 in 1989. The Abraham Lincoln Brigade, of which all are now presumed dead with the passing of Del Berg in February, was the American contingent of the international volunteer brigades from all over the Western world that fought for the doomed Spanish Republic against Franco and his Nazi and fascist allies from Germany and Italy. The Lincoln Brigade has ever since been blacklisted as a subversive organization by the U.S. government under the rubric that it was prematurely anti-fascist, but more truthfully, that its members were primarily Great Depression-spawned socialists and leftists. And what exactly does premature anti-fascist mean? Happy Bastille Day. This has been Michael McCusker.